You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at seavillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at seavillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Brian Wheeler was hired as Charlottesville Tomorrow's first executive director in July 2005. Mr. Wheeler has lived in the Charlottesville-Albemarle region since 1984. He represented the community as an elected member of the Albemarle County School Board from 2004 to 2010. Before that, Mr. Wheeler served as Chief Information Officer at SNL Financial, a leading provider of data to Wall Street. Prior to that, he was employed at the W. Alton Jones Foundation, a private family foundation that focuses on grant-making in support of environmental and international security projects. Mr. Wheeler received a BA in Foreign Affairs from the University of Virginia in May 1990. He spoke about yesterday's local election and what it could mean to our transportation future, water future, rural landscapes, and city. Mr. Wheeler spoke at the November 9, 2011 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Grace Zisk.
I was very happy to introduce Brian Wheeler. I'm sorry, because I threw in something that wasn't on here. But I've known him for a long time. And so, as I said, I'm glad to be able to introduce him. Sure, and first I'll talk about Charlottesville Tomorrow, although that won't be stealing your thunder, will it? Okay. It's a community news platform covering growth, development, and local politics. They connect you to vital information for making informed choices about our community's future. Through a partnership with the Daily Progress, the first of its kind in the nation, Charlottesville Tomorrow's reporting is now a regular feature in the pages of the newspaper. Brian Wheeler was hired as Charlottesville Tomorrow's first executive director in July 2005. He has lived in the Charlottesville-Albemarle region since 1954. 84. Well, I messed up on this one, folks. Anyway, Brian has represented the community as an elected member of the Albemarle County School Board during 2004-2010. During 1998 through 2005, he served as Chief Information Officer at SNL Financial, a leading provider of data to Wall Street. Prior to that, Mr. Wheeler was employed at the W. Alton Jones Foundation, a private family foundation that focused on grant making, supporting environmental and international security projects. Brian received a BA in Foreign Affairs at the University of Virginia in May 1990. He and his wife, Jean, have two children and currently live in Ivy. Brian Wheeler.
Stow my waters here. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here in front of the senior statesmen, and I'm looking forward to this opportunity to talk a little bit about Charlottesville Tomorrow and the elections that we just had. And it's great to see so many of you here excited about talking more about the election the day after, so to speak. So we do have a lot to talk about, but before we get into the election, I want to make sure we're all on the same page about Charlottesville Tomorrow, because I think for many of you, you may have come across our information. I know many of you are subscribers and donors, and for that I want to say thank you up front. But I know for others of you, we may be a new organization, or we may be taking an approach that you're not fully familiar with. So I want to make sure we're all on the same page about what Charlottesville Tomorrow is all about, and then we'll head into a discussion about these elections. I want to thank Grace for the nice introduction. Appreciate that. And just to by way of additional background, just mention I did come here in 1984 to go to the university and was fortunate to have never left after coming here. So I spent 6 years getting my undergraduate degree. I was on the extended tour of the university. And I started out in astrophysics. What actually brought me to Charlottesville was the telescope at Fan Mountain. And as a first-year student, I was privileged to be able to run that telescope as one of their observers. And that was a whole lot of fun, working both at the McCormick Observatory, which I had a key to. So that was my little hiding place where I would go study as a first-year student. I'd walk up there from the dorms and study in the basement of McCormick Observatory. And then I'd sneak down to Fan Mountain and take pictures of things that needed to be photographed. And at the time, Fan Mountain's telescope, if you've seen it, it's a sizable telescope, but it was not run by computers back then. You had to know a little bit about stars and where things were and point that telescope in the right direction. Things have changed a lot in astronomy and physics. I'm not going to talk about that because ultimately my degree was in government. So my tenure in astrophysics was very short. But that's what brought me here and helped me fall in love with this community. Met my wife at the university. She was in the nursing program there. And we've had two kids and are just, you know, thrilled to still be here. That said, it means that my, you know, sort of exposure to the world as an adult has always been within the context of the grounds at the university or the downtown mall. So my entire professional life as a working adult has been within a few blocks of the Charlottesville downtown mall. So that's what I know really well. And I think it also has helped prepare me to lead Charlottesville tomorrow and to think about the future of this community in a very intentional way. So let's talk about that. Charlottesville Tomorrow's mission is to help you make informed choices, not unlike what the senior statesmen try to do and the League of Women Voters and other groups like that. But we're focused on a subset of issues covering growth, development, local politics. And again, our goal is to connect you with the best information possible to make informed choices. Why is that important? In some of the pictures here, you're going to see some of those special things about this community, about this place, that we all cherish. Some of them may represent reasons why you decided to come here, why you moved to business here, why you retired here, why you came to work here. And when I show these images, it's just to remind everybody that it is a special place. And anywhere you've got, you know, a quaint small town and a university like the University of Virginia, it's going to be special. But it takes work to keep it special. And that's why Charlottesville Tomorrow was formed in 2005. My board of directors came together and said, we're going to have to work to keep this community looking like that, to keep this place special. People are going to come here. Met a couple here who just moved here 4 years ago, and lots more people are coming to this community, whether it's through the university, whether it's through the National Ground Intelligence Center. And so it wasn't a question for Charlottesville Tomorrow about whether we're going to grow, but it's about how and where is this community going to grow? What is it going to look like? What will our quality of life be like in the future? And the board of directors of Charlottesville Tomorrow said, we need to be pretty thoughtful about that. We need to make better choices. But you know what? There's an information gap. Back in 2005, we didn't think there was enough information about some of these critical quality of life issues facing the community. And so Charlottesville Tomorrow was formed not to take positions on those issues, but to make sure enough information was there so you could take informed positions on those issues. We focus on four big things: sharing information, local election coverage, which I'll focus on today, research on those quality of life issues, research to the point of doing exhibits, to the point of hiring architects to do visualizations, hiring polling firms, hiring consultants to do focus groups. We do in-depth research on this information to make sure that we're giving you the best that we've got. and then engaging the community. It's not just about putting information out there and hoping that you'll do something with it. We want to engage you in a conversation. Part of what I'm excited about today is engaging you in a conversation about the election. So I'm going to be asking you to ask me questions about some of these issues and some of the candidates. We want you to engage with us. I've got two staff here I want to introduce while we're on this slide. Jennifer Marley is in the back at our table. Jennifer's waving her hand there. Jennifer just joined us as our third full-time staff member. And Kurt Walters is our intern this semester. He grew up in the community, and he's now writing for us this semester. So we've got three-fourths of our staff here. Sean Tubbs is back at the office writing the next article on the Western Bypass, which will be in tomorrow's paper. But those are the four big things that Charlottesville Tomorrow focuses on. And one way we engage people is through our two websites, SeavilleTomorrow.org and SeavillePedia. Many of you have probably heard of Wikipedia, but I don't know if you knew there was a SeavillePedia. And that's something we put together and hope you'll take a look at. This is our website. It's really a simple blog. Now, back in 2005 when I said that, I had to explain what a blog was, right? I had to explain that it enabled this two-way conversation. And I remember telling my board that anybody could come to our website and leave a comment. And they weren't so sure that was a good idea at the time in 2005. And I talked about podcasting, and I had to explain what that was. Senior statesmen are very good at podcasting, and I'm glad this one will be podcast. But in 2005, we were on the cutting edge when it came to using blogs and podcasting and using technology to share information in innovative ways. As Grace mentioned, I was on the school board. And in 2005, when I started showing up at transportation meetings and setting down microphones, people looked at me with raised eyebrows and said, "Brian, we think you're in the wrong meeting. What are you doing here, and why are you recording us talking about transportation?" And I said, "You know what? It's all going to work out. This will all be fine. We're just going to record this gavel to gavel and share it with the community." And guess who was one of our biggest customers? The local media. We didn't start out as a media organization. We were there to share information in a nonpartisan, fact-based, impartial way. So we go to these meetings, record them, put the audio on the website. You don't even need an iPod. You can just click and listen to it right there on the website. But we were giving the public access to meetings they didn't even know were happening in this community. The local media didn't know they were happening. They didn't know they weren't reporting on them. And quickly, the local media started reading our website, taking those story ideas. What was good for us, it was sort of a game at the time. We were trying to get the media to pay attention to us, right? Because we thought we were getting some good information on the table. And it was sort of fun if we saw the story we had written previously show up on TV or in the newspaper. We didn't always get credit, and that was okay. We weren't worried about that. What we wanted to do is make sure the public was getting the best information possible. If we could get that reporter in the right frame of reference, and keep in mind, many of those reporters are in their first job, in their first community, and they're usually here for 2 years, and then they're gone. And then we hire another local reporter. Now, it's not true of WINA, the radio station, but it is true of the TV stations and the Daily Progress. Young reporters typically in their first jobs, because this is a small media market. So at Charlottesville Tomorrow, we said, you know what, we're going to take those people out to lunch. When they come to town, we're going to engage them, because they seem to be using our stuff. Let's make sure they know that we're here as a resource. They can call us anytime and ask us questions about these community issues, because we've been in the community a long time. We can help them figure these things out. So our website makes that information available, and now it's, you know, become an example of what new media can look like. In our case, it looks like a blog. We hope to make it look even better next year with a different kind of website. But for right now, it's a blog that facilitates that two-way conversation, allows us to share original documents from these meetings, share original audio, so that you can have access to the conversation. Now, I mentioned SeavillePedia, and that is our wiki, and we launched that I think we went live with it in 2009. I think we started it in 2007. It's just like Wikipedia. In fact, the folks that organized Wikipedia give that software away. So we took a copy of it, and we started creating a hyper-local community encyclopedia for our community. It's about all the people, places, events in our community's history. So some people, when I tell them that, they're like, well, why should I look at an article on Civopedia versus Wikipedia? Or why should I write an article in Civopedia versus Wikipedia? And the answer is, we're hyper-local. This is information we care about in this community, and the importance, the relevance of it to the rest of the world, we don't care about. We think it's important. We put it in there, right? Wikipedia has what are called notability guidelines. So if you're not notable enough, like me, you won't have a Wikipedia article about you, right? But in Charlottesville, we'll put anybody, we'll create an article for anybody in the community because everyone has a story to tell. And that helps us tell a better story. So Civopedia is in its early stages right now. We're just trying to share with people like you that it exists. And what's cool about it is it's a collaborative encyclopedia. Anybody can edit the information that's there. And if you look at our stories in our news center and you see hyperlinks, people's names will have a hyperlink. You click on that name. I see Madison Cummings there. Madison Cummings has an article about him in Civopedia. If you click on that his name in a story, it'll go to all the in-depth information we've got. We collect so much information, we can't get it all in a Daily Progress article or in an article on our website, but we want to make sure you have access to it. So Civopedia becomes a place we can put a lot of that information and you can get to that history. But it allows us to connect that information too. So we can connect the fact that Madison Cummings, not only did he run for Board of Supervisors, but he was also on the school board. And you can get access to all that information about those voting results. Now, those results are also on the State Board of Election website, but they're not connected. If you went to a candidate's performance in yesterday's election on the State Board of Elections, you really couldn't learn anything else about them except how they did in that one race. If you come to Civopedia, you can find out how they did on every race in this community and see that full history. That's just one example. I do want to talk a little bit about the changing patterns we're seeing in the consumption of news. So this graphic represents the Pew study that says that the public is spending more and more time consuming news, but they're doing it in a different way. So the bar on the left represents online usage of news. And comparing 2009 to 2010, online access to news has gone up 17%. Every other news format, local TV, network TV, newspapers, audio, magazines, cable TV, are on the decline in that year-to-year comparison by Pew. Now, that probably doesn't surprise you because you know more and more people are using the internet and getting information that way. Pew has quantified that. So again, 17.1% is the increase in people getting news from the internet. This is another Pew study, and it says that 46% of Americans are now getting their news from 4 to 6 sources. So it's not just the TV broadcast news and the newspaper. That's how I grew up, reading the Atlanta Constitution, watching my local news. Got to the University of Virginia, I'm reading the Washington Post. I remember my professors made me read, I'm blanking on the other newspaper. But anyway, I was reading multiple newspapers, watching the evening news. That is still a habit in our household. Gene and I watch ABC News every night on our DVR. But the habits are changing, especially as the next generation of voters and people engaged in our community are coming up. They're getting their information from more and more sources. The last item there, 75% of us are now getting news, some news, from social media. So by social media, we mean Twitter, Facebook, right? Those sites that help bring people together and share information that they want to share with their friends. They can say, hey, I read this story, click here, share it with my network. So that's what they mean by social media. I mean, that's a really big number, 75%. We decided we better ask our readers, Charlottesville Tomorrow's readers. We have about 2,700 subscribers to our email newsletter that goes out each week. So we asked them, where do you get your news? How do you know about us? So the big item there, it says 83%. Most people get our information from our weekly emails. We have a sign-up sheet back there. If you're not getting those emails, we will rectify that problem immediately because we want to get you signed up. So most people are getting our information via email. The other top two are from our website and then from articles in the Daily Progress. So 83% said they get it via email, 38% said they come to our website, 41% said they read it in the Daily Progress, the printed Daily Progress, and another 24% get it from the online version of the Daily Progress. Now, those two bars over to the far right are social media, Twitter at 4%, Facebook at 7%. So for us, for Charlottesville Tomorrow today, right, Twitter and Facebook are a small part of our audience, but it's still an audience. We know people are getting our information and sharing it via those social networks. What Pew is telling us is that's only going to go up. We ask our readers, 473 of them responded, which is about 17% of our readership. 26% said they have Twitter. 68% said they have Facebook. So that, you know, that says to me we need to be better at sharing information to those two communities because I think we have a large audience. We can grow there. Let's talk about the Daily Progress Partnership. This was started in 2009, and as of now, we're putting about 24 stories a month in the newspaper, and that's about 50% of the Daily Progress's growth and development beat, as they call it. So Charlottesville Tomorrow's two reporters and interns are responsible for half of the newspaper's coverage of growth, development, local politics. On the left is a cover story I did for the Daily Progress. I show that picture not because of the subject content, but because of it represents a lot of what is really good about this partnership. I don't have graphic designers who can communicate visually what this community water supply plan is all about. That's a diagram from several different perspectives of the earthen dam that's part of our water plan. The Daily Progress has people that can do that, so we can leverage that talent. In the bottom right corner is a little icon that represents a video that we did, a visualization, a 3D model that let folks fly around this dam in Google Earth. So that's another example of how we've come to the Daily Progress with some visualizations that they couldn't have done on their own. We produced those visuals, and they helped communicate that they were available for people to use. And then also we have our voter guides. One of the great things about the partnership was that the Daily Progress prints our voter guides. You know, they have a printing press. So that was an easy question for me to ask. Hey, can you do these voter guides? What we have here is a win-win partnership. And let me explain in detail why I think this civic media partnership, as I'll call it, is so effective. McGregor McCants is the managing editor at the newspaper. He and I went to the Darden School recently and gave a little talk about Charlottesville Tomorrow. And, you know, those business majors at Darden are into numbers. So I thought I'd give him some numbers about our partnership. And I put these numbers up and I said, okay, any questions? Of course, there were questions. So what do these numbers represent? Well, Charlottesville Tomorrow, as I said, has three full-time staff now. We've been in business 6 years. Our budget annually is about $280,000. We've put 415 stories in the Daily Progress over the past 2 years. That represents a 17% increase in the newspaper's coverage of these issues. It represents a 219% increase in traffic on Charlottesville Tomorrow's website, a whole lot more people are coming to our website because of this partnership. Zero is how much I'm getting paid by the Daily Progress to produce this content. And zero is the number of other organizations in the country that have this kind of relationship with a daily newspaper. So this is unique in Charlottesville, and I think it's quite a story. I want to show you graphically what some of the impact has been. This is a graph that I think would be pretty typical of any community in the country. And don't worry about the details as much as the trends of these three line graphs. These represent the three printed papers in town, our two weeklies and the Daily Progress. So the Daily Progress is the top line, and the time span along the bottom is from 2007 to present. And the vertical axis is the number of articles written about growth, development, local politics. So if you just look at the trends, without Charlottesville Tomorrow being involved, if you look at the trends of all three of our printed papers, they're all declining in their ability to cover civic media. Pew is, and the FCC have studied this, and their conclusion is, and it's backed up by this slide, an abundance of media does not ensure an abundance of civic media reporting in a community. Now, lots of decisions go into something like this. Resource decisions by Media General. How are we going to save money, be as efficient and effective as possible? Editorial decisions by these papers about what issues they want to cover. Now, Charlottesville Tomorrow doesn't cover crime. We don't cover education. So those things aren't reflected in these graphs. This is just growth and development, local politics. The trend is down in all three publications. Now you add in Charlottesville Tomorrow's impact. And this is what the Daily Progress looks like with our coverage. So I mentioned a 17% increase after the partnership in the newspaper's ability to cover civic media. And there you can see it. A couple other things Charlottesville Tomorrow's up to, and then we'll get into the local election. I mentioned the visualizations that we've done. This was a new project we started a little over a year ago. I've been writing about the water plan since 2005. I keep trying to come up with a new way to tell the story, right? New people come to town. It seems to get more and more complicated to folks, and we need a better way to help people visualize this very complex system and the complex choice our elected officials have to make. So in the top left corner, that's just one slide, but we did a whole series of visuals in Google Earth. And you've all seen these Google Earth zoom-ins on the terrain and the geography, right? So if you watch CNN, it happens all the time. They go to the reporter in, you know, some city, Wichita, Kansas, right? And in zooms the map on Google Earth, and then you see maybe some buildings in Wichita, and then they switch to the reporter. So they're always trying to show people, okay, let's give them a sense of the place where we're talking about, right? Google makes that really easy to do. I've never been to Boulder, Colorado, but I feel like I've been there because I keep flying around Pearl Street in Google Earth because that's another pedestrian downtown mall that we often talk about as a comparison to Charlottesville. Boulder, Colorado has just about every building in downtown Boulder in Google Earth. And you can fly around them and see what it looks like in 3D. It tells a whole different story. We said to ourselves, that's pretty neat. Maybe we can use it to tell a better story about the water plan. Maybe we can show people where this dam is going, what areas are going to be flooded, and how all these parts connect to each other. So Seaville 3D is part of that initiative to help people visualize these complex things. In the top right corner, we're training people how to do this themselves. We held SketchUp. SketchUp is the Google product that lets you build things in Google Earth. Google is wide open to having anyone build a building, submit it, publish it in the public Google Earth. Now, there's a little bit of a learning curve there, so we decided to start having trainings where people would come together and learn how to build buildings in Google Earth. So why would a news information organization like Charlottesville Tomorrow care about something like that? The reason is it helps us tell a better story. if we can help you visualize what's happening. But you know what? It's not just you. It's also the decision makers. I've sat through, I couldn't even count how many hours I've sat through Architectural Review Board, Planning Commission meetings, Board of Supervisor meetings, and there's a common thread to some of these things. Somebody brings in a plan that they want to get approved. And people are looking at these architectural drawings. They're trying to figure out, okay, what does this really mean for the community? How is this going to look in the entrance corridor of Albemarle County or the city of Charlottesville? What's the visual impact going to be? Well, that's an important question, because a lot of our quality of life has to do with how this community looks. And what I found was not every decision maker could convert, you know, a two-dimensional plan into three dimensions in their head and figure out even the right questions to ask, much less what it really looks like. So we started building some of the buildings for them before they made a decision. Bottom right corner is a gas station that's going to be built in Crozet. Now, it's not going to end up looking like that, but it'll be similar to that. That's called the Restorin Station. So we approached that developer and said to Joe Higgins, Joe, if you give us the drawings, we'd like to try to build your gas station. We're not taking a position whether it's good or bad. We just want to make sure the public knows exactly what it looks like. We want the residents who live near that gas station to be able to go in Google Earth, park at their house, and look and see what that gas station looks like. We want them to drive down 250 West and drive by that gas station. And what we're finding is the decision makers really like this. They're starting to ask for more 3D models. The developers of Stonefield, major project, you know, at Hydraulic and 29, it will be the size of two downtown malls. Stonefield, we have the Architectural Review Board saying, hey, can you put some 3D models together? We'd really like to fly around your project. That's what we want them to say, because we think that's going to lead to better decisions by our community. We're also engaging the youth in the community. We've got an ongoing partnership with Monticello High School. We've also done some work at Western Albemarle and the University of Virginia. I think it's really important, especially given my experience on the school board, to engage youth in these issues. If any of you read some of our stories over the summer, and you remember the name Frank Maraca, Frank had just graduated from Monticello High School. He spent his first summer out of high school writing for Charlottesville Tomorrow, put about a dozen stories in the newspaper, and he's got quite a portfolio to take with him to college. He did some good work, and that's a way we can engage our youth in our community's issues. And I just have so much appreciation for what these young people can do, and we want to give them that opportunity. So the tools that we're making available to you, the website, the wiki, we have an iPhone app if you have iPhones. We also look great on an iPad. So if you have an iPad, there's an application called Flipboard. Flipboard. I'd encourage you to use Flipboard and search for Charlottesville Tomorrow, and you'll get this great-looking magazine that you can flip through. And the great thing is we didn't have to do anything. Their application just makes our content look really good. So try using an iPad and getting exposure to that. A question I often get is, how do we pay for all this? And this is a breakout of our revenues. I mentioned the budget. It's about $280,000. Major gifts are about 45%, foundations 48%, and annual gifts are about 7%. And we rely on the generosity of this community to keep us going, and we hope you'll consider making a donation to support our work. Now let's get on to the meat of the conversation here and talk about the local elections. So let's just make sure we're all on the same page about who won. And I just want to say, well, I'm only going to talk about Charlottesville City Council and the Board of Supervisors in Albemarle County. There were lots of other important elections yesterday, but these are the two races that Charlottesville Tomorrow covers. So Charlottesville City Council, the winners were incumbent Satyendra Hooja, Kathy Galvin, and Dee Dee Smith, all Democrats. And then for the Board of Supervisors, Ken Boyd, the incumbent, won from the Ravana District, Chris Dummler, newcomer, Democrat, won from Scottsville, and Ann Malik, also an incumbent, was reelected. She was unopposed in the Whitehall District. Let's talk about each of these races. So Charlottesville City Council. There are five seats on City Council, and these three people that were just elected will join Dave Norris and Kristen Zekas. So those will be your five city councilors for the next 2 years. It was a Democratic sweep, obviously, and they finished in the same order that they did in the Democratic primary. So the conventional wisdom is the election in Charlottesville is the Democratic primary. And I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying there's nothing here to change the conventional wisdom at this point, right? What happened in the Democratic primary is what happened on Election Day, despite the fact that there were four independents on the ballot. There are actually five. One of them dropped out, but there were four still in the running. Those independents were not even close to getting elected. So the all-Democratic council we have today stays all-Democratic. Let me talk about some other observations. And again, I'm going to count on you guys to ask me some questions. So start thinking of those. One of my observations is that the independents running, if they're focused on a single or a limited set of issues, at least in the city of Charlottesville, that doesn't seem to work. And we saw this in 2009 as well. So I think that's something to think about. You know, a single limited issue campaign as an independent is not reaching enough voters to get you elected. That said, the independents are doing a great thing for democracy, right? They're giving people a choice, and they're ensuring that the Democrats sort of don't get a free ride, right? That they're going to be challenged on their positions. They're going to be asked tough questions at candidate forums. And it makes sure that there is a public debate about these issues. So I think it's very important. I mean, I would like to see people from every party. I'd like to see Republicans running in the city, because I think that's good for democracy. Again, I'm a student of Larry Sabato's at the University of Virginia, so politics is a good thing in his books, right? So that's what I've been trained to believe, and I do believe that. I think that ensures a better debate about these public policy issues. Now, leadership in the city, either Kristen Zekas or Satyendra Ahuja will be our next mayor. So Dave Norris is going to finish out his term as mayor December 31st, and then the next city council will pick who it wants to have as its mayor. We don't have a direct elected mayor in this community. Now, the odds-on favorite is Satyendra Ahuja, but I added Kristen Zekas' name there because it's our understanding that this could be an ongoing discussion about who's going to end up receiving that position. But it's going to be one of those two. So think about that as far as the future of Charlottesville. Now, when it comes to the water plan, that was one of the big issues in the city, the 50-year community water plan. Well, the current majority of councilors support it. Because of these elections, the next majority is going to support it. So again, that was really decided, and looking back, we can say it was really decided at the Democratic primary. The Democrats that won the primary, two of the three, support the water plan. So Kathy Galvin, Satyendra Ahuja, both support the water plan. D.D. Smith favors dredging before building another dam. But she and Mayor Norris will be the two votes. With that position, the three-vote majority will be to support the plan. Another thing that I think is going to be really interesting, especially given my school board experience, is that we have two former school board members just elected to city council. So D.D. Smith and Kathy Galvin are going to bring that experience, but the two of them individually also have this knack for data-driven decisions and analytics. So the tenor of the conversation at Charlottesville City Council is going to be a whole lot different over the next 2 years with those two women asking for numbers to back up different decisions that City Council might be facing. All right, let's talk briefly about the Board of Supervisors. So we have six seats, six magisterial districts on the Albemarle Board of Supervisors. Three of them were decided in this election. The three winners will join Dennis Rooker, independent, Dwayne Snow, a Republican, and Rodney Thomas, a Republican. I would say yesterday's election was a split decision for the political parties, right? Ken Boyd won as a Republican. Chris Dumler won as a Democrat. So on face value, split decision. Ann Malik wasn't opposed. I think, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is that that basically keeps the party labels the same that they are today. So next year, we're still going to have three Republicans, two Democrats, and one independent on the Board of Supervisors. So the party makeup doesn't change. We'll come back to that in a moment. What has changed is that now the stage is set in Albemarle County for a 3-3 stalemate on many issues, many of the most contentious issues. We're going to see 3-3 tie votes or the absence of a vote because they realize there isn't a majority to vote on something. We've been there before, and now we're back to this period. Other observations about the Albemarle County supervisor elections. It ends what was essentially a Republican majority. I mean, Lindsay Dorier was a conservative Democrat, but he voted with the Republican majority on most of the contentious issues around the Western Bypass, taxes, the environmental issues related to what are known as cool counties, some of the sustainability initiatives. So that was seen as a conservative block. And that period is now going to be over with Chris Dumler coming in from Scottsville. But again, as I said, prepare for this return to a 3-3 stalemate on some key issues. Now, in Scottsville, I would say that both of those candidates wanted to say they were the most like Lindsay Dorier. So in Scottsville, you know, Lindsay Dorier has been doing this for a long time. Everybody knows Jane and Lindsay, and is very well respected. And neither of them wanted to trample on Lindsay's record. Both of them wanted to admire all the great things about Lindsay Dorier and say they were the next heir apparent to that tradition. And I guess I would say Chris Dumler was the young version of Lindsay Dorier, right? Lawyer, fresh out of school, starting his own practice. They have in common, they both were in the JAG school, Judge Advocate General, as lawyers. And Chris very much said, you know, I'm the next guy. I'm the next generation of leaders. Jim Norwood, the Republican that lost, was, you know, sort of the experienced Lindsay Dorier, or senior statesman, maybe. He was the experienced version of Lindsay Dorier. Been in the community, I think he's been here 9-10 years, but he said, you know what, I'm a businessman, I have a track record, you can judge me on some of the things I've already done in this community. That was the big surprise to me in that race, was that Chris Dumler won with the margin of victory that he did. After watching some of those debates, I really thought that Jim Norwood was positioning himself better to be viewed as the next Lindsay. But obviously the Scottsville district was ready for something else. Another key about the Scottsville district is the performance in the Kale precinct. So the Kale precinct is where a lot of the growth is, the development area just south of I-64. And I've always said to people, if you want to win a nomination for the Scottsville Democrat or Republican seat, just walk through all the neighborhoods in Kale and tell people you need to borrow them for a couple hours, bring them to a caucus and get their vote, and then you'll be the nominee. And I think what Chris Dumler did was a lot of door-to-door campaigning. And I think that shoe leather made a difference for Chris Dumler. In Ravana, you know, Ken Boyd and Cynthia Neff was the Democrat, they both staked out really different positions. And Cynthia had a different challenge, where Jim and Chris were an open seat race for Scottsville, replacing Lindsay. Cynthia Neff had to face an incumbent, somebody who's been on the Board of Supervisors a while and served on the school board before that. So she had to stake out and make the case that she was different from the incumbent. And I think they are probably, you know, I would say it's fair to say they are known as candidates in their parties who are not in the center of things. I would say they're both further out. So I would say Cynthia Neff is more down that liberal trend line, for a Democrat, and I would say Ken Boyd is further down as a conservative Republican. And both of them campaign that way. And I think in a race where you have two people operating in those zones, the incumbent has a tremendous advantage. And I think that's what played out in the Ravana district. The other thing that played out in the Ravana district was it didn't matter how much money Cynthia Neff raised. She outraised Ken Boyd by a lot. But message and tactics, I think, are more important than how much money you raise. Now, you got to raise money to get your message out, but you also have to be smart on the message. Leadership. Dwayne Snow was going to be the next chairman of the Board of Supervisors. The reason is the Board of Supervisors has a rotation scheme. So they try to take the politics out of who's the next chair. And frankly, most of the time, they don't really care who the chair is. I mean, the chair, the mayor, really the power you have is over the agenda and not over the decisions that are made. So Dwayne Snow is going to be the next chairman because it's his turn next year. So let's talk about some of these issues, and then I'll take your questions. And remind me what time we're wrapping up. 3 o'clock. Excellent. Because now we're heading into some good stuff. I think the, now granted, my focus at Charlottesville Tomorrow is more narrow, and so you'll have to bear with me on that. So I'm not going to be talking about education issues. I'd love to, but when Charlottesville Tomorrow launched, I was still on the school board, so we couldn't cover education. So we haven't gone there yet. I hope we will in the future. But I'm going to talk about, of the issues we cover, I think these are the big ticket items that this election will shape in a significant way over the next 2 years. Because we're with these candidates now for 2 years. So the stage is set, and then we'll have local elections again in 2013. Of course, the great thing in Virginia is there's an election every year, right? 50-year water supply plan. As I said, you know, the surprise was sort of taken away when we knew all the supervisors running and in power already support the plan. And then the Democratic primary decided two of the three Democrats who would be on council also support it. So now we have a city council and a board of supervisors for the next 2 years. They're on the record as saying they support the plan. Now, that doesn't mean things won't get contentious or hotly debated, especially when it comes to cost sharing, because that's the next big debate. Who's going to pay for the $140 million water plan? Right? The county has said we're going to pay for as much of it as represents our need for growth, because most of the growth is going to happen in the county. The city is going to have to pay for UVA's growth. They won't have to pay for it, but they'll have to account for that in their part of the cost sharing. The University of Virginia buys its water from the city of Charlottesville. Our communities, you've all figured this out, but our communities are so interlocked when it comes to pipes and when it comes to roads, right? That's where a lot of these things come together. The next issue, the Western Bypass. You know, it doesn't really matter what City Council thinks about the Western Bypass at this point. The Board of Supervisors made a decision this year. They set that course at the Metropolitan Planning Organization. The Commonwealth Transportation Board has allocated some money for this project. The governor supports it. So right now, even with Chris Dumler being elected, and Chris was sort of circumspect about the bypass. He said, you know, it's not a perfect bypass. I might have supported it when it first came up, but, you know, I don't think it's that important to the Scottsville district. You know, it's state money. It's not local money being spent on this. And even with Dumler on board, replacing Doerr, who voted for it, go back to that 3-3 stalemate. So let's say that Dennis Rooker wanted to make a motion to kill the bypass. That motion would fail. 3-3 tie. So once something is in motion by the Board of Supervisors, three votes cannot undo it. That's very important. Some of these sustainability initiatives, Cool Counties, the Tea Party really rallied around getting the Board of Supervisors to back off from its commitment to some of these green initiatives and sustainability. And the case they made was outside intervention by the United Nations, by other interest groups that wanted to dictate choices about how you live your lives, about how you drive, where you live, what you do. So for them, it was about freedom of choice. And they convinced a majority of the Board of Supervisors to back away from those commitments they made to sustainability and cool counties. Now, in fairness, they said those things that are related to local government and us being efficient with our energy usage and our buildings, let's by all means do those just because those are smart things to do. We should do that anyway. We don't need some outside group or some outside protocol or some outside measurement system to tell us that's a good thing. We should do those things anyway. And that was the argument that won the day. So let's say Ann Malik wanted to change that. I make a motion, we rejoin ICLEI. That motion fails, 3-3. So those things are not going to change. And the Western Bypass falls into that category. Now that said, about the Western Bypass, I want to point out there's a whole lot of unfinished business on the Western Bypass. There's a whole lot of opportunity for the public to be involved and to shape what ultimately happens. So there are going to be decisions about what the design looks like. There will be decisions about how much more we study traffic models. There will be decisions about how much more we study environmental issues. And those are all very important. So the environmental groups, Southern Environmental Law Center, Piedmont Environmental Council, they're going to lobby heavily to make sure, and there'll probably be a lawsuit filed to stop the bypass. So there's going to be a protracted effort, I envision, over the next several years, fighting that project. So we'll see how much momentum VDOT and the powers that be have to keep that project moving. But right now it's in motion. They put it out for bid. We're waiting for contractors to submit bids and designs for that Western Bypass. We can talk more about that with your questions. All right, Albemarle's growth areas. This is something that is going to change. Had Jim Norwood been elected from Scottsville, I think we would have seen fast and furious activity early in 2012 to expand Albemarle County's growth areas. That's not going to happen, I predict. Not because I have a say in the outcome, but just I don't like being wrong, right? So my prediction is that there are about a dozen requests right now in front of the board to consider expanding growth areas. So Albemarle County, as you know, 5% has had lines drawn around it, and they've said that's where we want growth. That's where we have the infrastructure, roads, schools, pipes, etc. The rest of Albemarle County, 95%, should be as rural as possible. Now, if you ask a board member about that, all of them unanimously say that's the case. They want to protect the rural countryside. It's one of the things that makes this place great. It protects our water supply. It promotes tourism in our agricultural community. That said, the Board of Supervisors was a bit miffed when the state came in and bought Biscuit Run. And they took 800 acres of Albemarle County designated growth area and they declared it was a state park. They didn't ask the Board of Supervisors if that was okay. They just did it. Right? Biscuit Run's actually 1,200 acres. Another 400 was already in the rural area. So they got 800 acres of designated growth area. And the business community, the development community in town is saying we need to replace that 800 acres. We need to rebalance the scale. We lost 800 acres. There was going to be thousands of homes. We need to get that residential building capacity somewhere else. You're going to hear that argument made over and over again. One of the questions we ask these candidates was it important where that happened? If you're going to expand the growth area, is it important to consider whether it's in the watershed of the South Fork Ravana Reservoir? Because if you build in that watershed, you're increasing the potential for stormwater runoff and more sediment to go into the reservoir. And most of those candidates said, yes, it was important to think about, be thoughtful about where that growth happened. So I expect that we're going to see pretty thoughtful deliberations about where and if Albemarle County should grow. Another thing to keep an eye on, this fall there will be what's called the Targeted Industry Study. Albemarle County, along with the university and the city, are studying what industries we might want to attract here. What kind of jobs do we want to have in Charlottesville, in Albemarle, to have economic vitality? That's going to be a big driver in the types of land that are sought after to support business. So think about the interstate interchanges along I-64. What's something you notice about them? Not a whole lot going on at those interchanges compared to other communities. And there's a reason for that. The comprehensive plan for Albemarle County says there will not be development at those interchanges. We don't want people to land at an interchange and see Cracker Barrel or see big signs or those kinds of things that you see in any place USA, everywhere else in the country. That's not my position. That's what the comprehensive plan says. That is going to be revisited. And so that's another thing to look for. And one of the places that will be looked at hard is out in Crozet at Yancey Mills, because there's a pending request to pull in, I think it's about 184 acres, into the growth area in Crozet at the I-64 exit behind the Yancey Mills lumber yard to make a light industrial business park. So light industry is seen as an area where we don't have enough acreage to support companies that want to be here or want to expand in Albemarle County. So you need to think about that in the context of growth area expansion. But again, because of the way the election turned out and this 3-3 dynamic, I think it's not certain how that's going to go. It's certainly not going to go as strongly in favor of expansion as it might have otherwise. All right, the budget and strategic plans. The county's tax rate is always a contentious issue, the real estate property tax rate. With the 3-3 split, let's say somebody wants to raise the taxes from 74.2 cents to 80 cents. Somebody makes that motion. Oh, motion fails. Can't go there. Somebody else says, well, I'll lower the tax rate by a dime, 64.2 cents. That motion fails. We've seen this in past, boards. So they're going to be stuck on figuring out how to negotiate and horse trade on the tax rate in Albemarle County. A lot of that discussion is going to be around capital projects. What are the major capital investments our community needs to make? Is it the Crozet Library? Is it schools? Is it more roads? So watch the capital budget. And one of the things I tell people that surprises them is when the biggest meeting of the year is that shapes the budget. Does anybody know when the biggest meeting of the year is that shapes the budget? Besides Madison. Madison knows. It's today. The Board of Supervisors meets today on their 5-year financial plan. And even though we have a new board coming on, the county executive is going to get his marching orders today and tomorrow on the budget. Now, Lee Catlin was on the radio this morning, community spokesperson, and Lee Catlin was careful to say they're not deciding anything. It's not the budget. It's the 5-year financial plan. We're just looking long term. I've been in all those meetings. They're making decisions, all right? And they're going to put in, it may be in pencil, but it's going to be written down, a tax rate assumption. In fact, an assumption for the next 5 years. But that assumption is going to heavily influence the budget that the county executive is comfortable bringing back to his board. His board gave him marching orders. He's got to bring that back. So watch, tomorrow's paper. The Daily Progress will be writing that story. But see how that conversation turns out tomorrow. And then tomorrow they're going to have a school board joint meeting, talk about school budget. So these two meetings, today and tomorrow, are very important to next year's budget. Strategic plan, I want to give a nod to the city here. I think, as I mentioned, with Dee Smith and Kathy Galvin coming on to city council, they're going to start asking a lot of questions about how the city measures its performance. The city has what are called city council priorities, right? You can get those on their website. I've been the only member of the public who has sat through the past two city council retreats. You know why that is? They hold them in Stanton. City council retreats for real to Stanton to talk about how they're doing. And you know how they measure how they're doing? They ask each other, how are we doing? I'm not making this up. You know, and I know this is being podcast, but I sit through those retreats, and that's how they evaluate their performance. Now, to be fair, I think the new city manager, Maurice Jones, has been given some marching orders to come up with performance measurements, key performance indicators, all those buzzwords. So I think there are plans in motion, but those plans are going to get a lot of momentum with Kathy Galvin and Dee Dee Smith joining city council. They're going to ask, because they've been trained as school board members to look for these things. And they're going to ask that they measure how they're doing with children, with affordable housing, with jobs. So look for that. I think that's going to be exciting to cover. Comprehensive planning. You know, the city and county have gotten a 3-year federal grant. This grant was actually one of the things that really got the Tea Party motivated to get involved with the Board of Supervisors. And they asked them to not accept the federal $1 million grant to do a 3-year joint planning process. But that planning process is ongoing. It's going to happen. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see, again, somebody like a Kathy Galvin, who brings a planning and architecture background. There are going to be much different discussions by Charlottesville City Council about things like density. Density. How dense should our housing be in the city? When we redevelop, how tall should we go in the city? And what are the repercussions of that? Is it good for public transit to have more people? Does that make transit work better? Most people say it does. But is that right for the city of Charlottesville? So that density question and public transit issues will be a big part of the comprehensive plan for their discussion. In the county, a lot of the planning is going to be around, again, that sort of designated growth area discussion and transportation. So I'll jump straight to this next one, Meadow Creek Parkway, McIntyre Park. Meadow Creek Parkway, from the county's perspective, it's done, right? They're ready to open that road. Ken Boyd cannot wait to open that road. Well, he can wait. He said he'd wait till next month. One of the things I tell the students at, when I meet with them at Monticello that's fun about the Meadow Creek Parkway, I try to help them understand the funding challenge for transportation in Virginia. The funding challenge. Now, I did this before the Western Bypass happened. Its funding challenge has sort of been, you know, mitigated by a decree from the governor to make that money available. But before the Western Bypass and the hundreds of millions of dollars going there, we really didn't have any money for transportation. Now, Ken Boyd, Rodney Thomas, Dwayne Snow, their position was the reason we didn't have any money because we weren't playing fair on the Western Bypass, right? Because we kept blocking the Western Bypass, the state kept shafting us when it came to giving money to the Commonwealth Transportation Board to dole out. I think there's something to that argument. And when they started complaining about where we were per capita, that's when they said, okay, we'll fix that. Here's a couple hundred million, build the Western Bypass. But that per capita argument, let's talk about that. So how much money are we talking about? It's called secondary road funding. What does that mean? A secondary road is any road numbered 600 and above. So if it's Route 29, two-digit number, below 600, that's a primary road. Any road numbered 600 or up is secondary. Meadow Creek Parkway is a secondary road. So how much money do we get from the state? Because the state is supposed to pay for transportation. local government's supposed to pay more for schools, state is supposed to pay more for transportation. That's sort of the long-time deal in Virginia. Well, we get about $330,000 from the state every year to build roads. $330,000. So I asked the students, you know, what president would have been, who would have been president of the United States if we had to start collecting money for the Meadow Creek Parkway back in the day at that rate? Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson could have approved the Meadow Creek Parkway, and we still wouldn't have had enough money to build it. Now, we used to get upwards of $5.5 million a year. But even that, for a project like the Meadow Creek Parkway, which is a $76 million road and interchange, all three parts, $76 million, you know, it'd take 232 years to save up enough money. So not even Thomas Jefferson. If just to pay for what Albemarle's already built, it would take 100 years at that rate. So we have a serious issue with funding of transportation in Virginia. That's going to be a statewide issue. It's going to be an issue in the next governor's race. Here locally, the Meadow Creek Parkway, barring an outcome in a federal lawsuit that's still being discussed right now, we expect that ruling late this year, early next year. There's a federal lawsuit. The opponents of the parkway have said, basically, they've filed against the interchange, so where the road would intersect with the 250 bypass, right at the skate park and the rescue squad. They have filed a lawsuit to stop that and said that the state and the federal government have illegally segmented the Meadow Creek Parkway into three different projects. They're saying you shouldn't have done that. You should have looked at it as one thing and then done an environmental impact study on that whole thing. And their argument is people were playing tricks and splitting it up into three things to make it look like something else. All right? So that's the lawsuit that's still pending. If that lawsuit is unsuccessful, this road's going to get built. So the powers that were elected yesterday will support the Meadow Creek Parkway. McIntyre Park. This is going to be a real interesting conversation in the city of Charlottesville. So it's the eastern side of McIntyre Park. So the part where the McIntyre Golf Course is today, where the Meadow Creek Parkway is intended to go. And they're starting a master planning process. But this majority on city council who favors the Meadow Creek Parkway, I think that's going to allow a different kind of conversation to happen about the future of McIntyre Park. One of the issues that I wrote about recently was a botanical garden proposal. So it's things like that. And whether it's golf, football, soccer, botanical garden, just leave it the way it is, that's all going to be part of this master planning discussion. So if you're city residents, or county residents for that matter, you can get involved and participate in those discussions. Finally, city-county UVA cooperation. And I think one thing I point out here is that things are pretty good with city-county UVA cooperation. A lot of people don't realize that because, you know, the headlines, and we're as much to blame for this. I mean, we're focusing on some very contentious issues, the bypass, the water plan, Meadow Creek Parkway. But if you step back and look at the city-county UVA, there's a whole lot of good cooperation that's happening. So I want to get that out there first. I think the people elected yesterday are going to make that a more positive situation than it has been. So I think it's pretty positive now, except for these contentious issues. But on those contentious issues, I think things are going to take a turn for the better with the group that was just elected. And I say that because of the way they're talking about these issues and what they have in mind. And instead of seeing the city and county as always butting heads, they are seeing the city and county fitting together. And how can we figure out as a community, as one community? One of the things that shocked me was how many people said in our interviews of the candidates, this is one community. Well, a lot of us believe that, but I hadn't heard many elected officials saying that recently. But when you ask them, they do feel that way. So they see the communities coming together, and they want to plan for the best outcome. They know we're all in this together, whether it's on the water or the roads, and we got to figure out a good plan and work towards those solutions. And I said I was going to ask for questions as we went, but I just sort of got on a roll there. So we'll come back to questions. Let me give you two more slides, and then I'll be completely done. I wanted to talk about some things we're going to do to engage you in all of those issues I just talked about. One of the things is we're going to start having monthly meetups, a.k.a. the news and brews. I mentioned, I'm in love with the downtown mall. So we will be on the downtown mall at some venue, or maybe we'll move it around a little bit into the county as well. Now, our first one is next Wednesday. Is that right, Jennifer? So Wednesday the 16th, we're going to meet at SIPS. And the journalist from the Daily Progress and Sean Tubbs and myself, we're going to have a conversation like this with whoever's willing to show up and chat with us about the local elections. But we're going to do this each month as a way to reach more people, make sure they know about us, and do it in a fun way where we can engage people in a two-way conversation and all learn from each other. So I think this will be good. One of the reasons we're able to do this now is that we have Jennifer Marley on our staff. The reason we have Jennifer is because we got a grant from the Knight Foundation, the John and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Charlottesville Area Community Foundation. The Community Foundation here applied to Knight to get money to help support community news. And they were successful. A match was arranged through the Community Foundation. And so that has allowed us to hire Jennifer and to focus more intentionally on community engagement. I think that's a big part of Charlottesville Tomorrow's sort of recipe for sustainability, is making sure more people know about us, more people are using our information, and more people are getting engaged in this content, because I think it's, as you can tell, so important. Another thing Charlottesville Tomorrow will do is hold a second annual community issues forum. We did this last year at the Omni. I know some of you were there. We invited in an outside speaker. We had a great discussion about economic vitality and community character. We'll pick another topic for this coming year. We'll want to make sure all of you get invited to come to that community conversation. Those are two face-to-face things we're going to do, but we're also going to improve our website and our communications effort. I mentioned the social media focus we're going to have. We're going to make more effective use of that. We're also going to promote more the use of Civilpedia to get you guys working on that. So again, our goal with engaging the community is to get people engaged, knowledgeable, and taking action, taking civic action. We're not going to tell you what to do. We just want you to do something. We want you to write a letter. We want you to come to a meeting. We want you to vote. That's what Charlottesville Tomorrow is all about, getting people engaged and taking action on those community issues. We hope you will join us by signing up. We hope you will support us by making a gift. The only reason we can do this work is that it's community-supported news and information. So we need your help. All right. With that, Grace is going to help me with questions. We'll go through as many of them as we can in the next 15 minutes.
Is it on? Yeah, it is. I just thought I'd like to make a comment about the thought that something never will happen. We were never going to get the bypass. The city said nothing would ever happen going east, even though Mr. Hoosier wanted us to expand east on 250. Look what's out there now. And I remember when everybody said nothing would expand south down 20. Never is a very long time.
I can't add anything to that. Never is a long time. I think, I'm trying to be careful and focusing on the next 2 years and sort of reading the tea leaves of what I see with these elected officials and what they're going to be willing to do. But you're absolutely right. I've learned it's hard to predict local politics.
I have another compliment or comment. I just downloaded your iPhone app while I was sitting here. Looks good.
Thank you.
Good design for the first version of it. I assume that you've got some process underway to get an Android version.
Great question.
Yeah, you should. but the iPhone one looks useful, and so I expect to look at it from time to time because it's got local news headlines right up front.
Thank you. I think that is important in our future, that we have apps for all those different platforms. That's a real challenge for a small nonprofit like Charlottesville Tomorrow. The reason we have that app is a group of programmers approached us and they said, we're going to invite a whole bunch of people to Charlottesville and we need a project that they can work on for a day and turn it over and say, hey, look what we did. And they came to us and said, can we do an app for you? I said, sure. So that's the first version because it was a freebie. And fortunately, it's still up and running, and they do good work, and they've helped maintain it. So we appreciate their donating that to us. But, you know, I think as we look at our communications platform for next year, we want to have a website and a full toolkit so that whether you're on an iPad, an iPhone, an Android phone, our information is going to look compelling and engaging and be useful for you. Thank you.
I presume that Charlottesville Tomorrow takes no advocacy positions whatsoever.
That's correct. Is that correct? We don't take a position on the issues or the candidates.
Second question. On the bypass, if it turns out to be the higher number, we're not going to build half a bypass, like half a parkway, I presume. What do you see as the solution there?
Right. So we've certainly seen and shared through our reporting and the Daily Progress's reporting internal emails and the discussion VDOT has been having about what will the bypass cost. The initial reaction by some of the VDOT staff was, you know, first we got to find the files. These things haven't been dusted off in years. And then we've got to take a fresh look at them. Oops, we never finished designing the northern terminus. So we got to figure that out. So there are a whole lot of unanswered questions, whether it's $250 million, you know, about what they've expected and what they've allocated, or whether it goes up to $400 million is now a question that's going to be talked about over the next year. What happens if it comes in at $400 million? You know, Ken Boyd, one of the supporters of the bypasses, said, well, that's a whole different conversation. That's a conversation we'll be watching and reporting on, but I don't know what's going to happen.
I've been a fan of Charlottesville Tomorrow for a while. I'm thinking about your work right this minute in the context of having seen this terrific documentary on the New York Times during the film festival. And the creative brew that's going on now about the creation of new media. How do you fit yourself in there? I mean, how do you compare yourself, say, to ProPublica, which seems to be the other best-known objective source of information?
Yeah. So Dick Toefel from ProPublica was in our community recently, and he spoke at a Chamber of Commerce luncheon. And I was fortunate to have our leadership team and the Daily Progress leadership team all sit down together with him before he spoke. So we learned a little bit more about ProPublica. So think of them as sort of an investigative news nonprofit, whereas Charlottesville Tomorrow is more civic media, right, for local government. So we're a hyper-local community news organization. We're certainly not as well funded as ProPublica. We don't have anywhere near the staff, but we also are operating on a much smaller, you know, jurisdiction. So I think, and what Mr. Toefel said was, you know, here's the future right here. The printed newspaper, those days are numbered, right? And I think they're even less than what a lot of people believe is going to happen. People are going to be consuming news more and more via tablets, via their phones, via their computers, their TVs, whatever. And so I see us as well positioned for whatever comes next, because we've built a model for how we can keep the civic media and this news in front of you. And I think we've shown that people will support that by making gifts to keep it going, because they realize in a town like this, especially a college town where people expect to have that information at their fingertips, the feedback I get from folks is, we believe in what you're doing. We want to help support you to keep doing it. So I think we're one model. And what we've tried to do is partner with a for-profit company because it gives us a way to reach a much larger audience. Now, what we do in 5 years, who knows? This is, you know, we're going to look at any media partnership we can that will help us get a message out. And we'll see where this goes. Yep.
If you were asked to cite one or two elections, the outcomes of which you were really surprised, and not limiting it to just the city council and the board of supervisors, could you tell us what election or elections those would be?
Of the ones that happened yesterday?
Yeah. Yes.
Because otherwise I was going to say my election. No. I know Connie Brennan, and I wasn't really following that race. So I think that's the 59th House District. I think that's right. But again, part of my tunnel vision this time of year is so focused on these races, I'm going to get in trouble if I leave that frame. But that surprised me. That's the one that jumps out the most.
That the independent candidates have little chance of success, and also that there's an infrequent appearance of a Republican candidate. To me, it seems that that's the result of the at-large rather than ward election scheme, and also the reason we, at this present time, have no minority representation either.
I think that's a valid perspective. I'm not sure I share it. I need to think about that. We did ask all the candidates for city council if they supported ward-based elections. One of the interesting things about that, so this would divide up the city into wards and each would have a representative. One of the ideas that came out of those answers was a mix. Have some at-large, some ward-based. Other people said we should have a direct election of the mayor. My guess is, again, reading the tea leaves, I think change like that is very difficult for people. So I think changing that system is going to be hard to do. Is one system better than the other? I don't really have an opinion on that. I'm not sure that's the biggest driver, though, of the racial makeup and the party makeup. I'm not sure that doesn't hold for me, Jerry, but a lot of people share your thoughts on that.
I want to follow up on a couple of questions that Tom and Jim mentioned. What is the impact that you have learned that your information has done on the issues? Not the candidates, just the issues. What impact have you made on these issues?
That's a great question. You know, when you're an organization not taking positions, we don't get to celebrate or get upset about the outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. Which makes it hard to measure your effectiveness to some degree. I found a lot people are putting a lot of money into campaigns and politics because they want to fund a winning campaign. Mm-hmm. It's harder to raise money for a nonprofit that's saying we want everyone to have a better conversation and make informed choices. It's a tough sell, but I've been making that pitch for 6 years now. So hopefully I'm getting better at it. I guess what I would say is my observation is our focus on the water supply, on the Western Bypass, has ensured that all the candidates running have to know those issues very well. And it ensures that the public has at their fingertips information which they can challenge all those officials all along the way. The other observation would be a whole lot more people are coming to public meetings than they did before Charlottesville Tomorrow, especially in the county. So one example, Albemarle Place. Again, that development, or now called Stonefield, the development at Hydraulic and 29. It's the size of two downtown malls. Three people showed up at the public hearing. Two of them were paid to be there. Public hearings now in Albemarle County about major developments are a whole lot different. I can't measure how much of that is Charlottesville Tomorrow, but I got to think some of it is.
Two questions. One is a technical question that came up with the first screen, where you identify yourself with the Daily Progress, but you also give me a confusion by using the names Civilpedia, mm-hmm. Seville.
Yeah.
Are you associated with Seville in any way?
As in Seville Weekly?
Yes.
No, we're not.
That's a little confusing.
Another question I get is, why aren't we Albemarle tomorrow? Why are we Charlottesville tomorrow? And I think, you know, one of the things I've always felt is, you know, when I'm elsewhere in the country and people ask, where do I live? I say, I live in Charlottesville. I mean, technically, I live in Ivy, Virginia. My mailing address is Charlottesville. I've always worked in the city. So, you know, how do we describe this thing? We thought about, in 2005, doing Charlottesville-Albemarle tomorrow. Kind of a mouthful. So we just settled on Charlottesville. We try to make up for that by making sure we cover places like Crozet, the Glenmore area, heavily as well, so that we're not leaving anybody out. We try to cover all the bases there. Sevillepedia, again, was a, you know, it's a tight name, and it's like Wikipedia, but it plays on our name, Charlottesville Tomorrow, so we call it Sevillepedia.
Second question I have is in regard to the number of people who voted in this election yesterday.
Yep.
What would your comment be about those rather minimal groups?
Pathetic. And disappointing. I mean, Charlottesville's turnout, 26%, I think. Guess what it was in 2007 and 2006, the other sort of off-year elections, 26%. 22? That was yesterday, it was 22? Oh, earlier. So it's always been pathetic in the city in these off-election years. I told my board of directors last week, I said, I can't wait to see the turnout numbers, because we'll, for the first time, get to see two cycles after Charlottesville Tomorrow was formed where there's similar things were on the ballot, 2007, 2011. So I'm deeply disappointed that all the effort we put in to sharing information about the city council elections, putting out the voter guides, mailing them to every single household, didn't bump that number up. So it's disappointing. The county numbers are higher, but it's not over 50%. I think we'll be lucky if it's over 40% on average. The contested races will have a higher number, but it's disappointing. How can that many people not be voting in any community? Because the people that show up make the decisions. That's what I tell the students at Monticello and Western and University of Virginia when I meet with them. And I go back to that story about if you wanted to get elected in Albemarle County at the caucus, you know how many people show up and make that decision? 120? 150 maybe votes? So the people that show up at a caucus for either party, Republican, Democrat, in Albemarle County, they're the ones picking the nominees for that party. So it's not just on election day, but, you know, democracy is a participation sport. You got to get in there and participate at all different opportunities.
I'd like to have a show of hands of how many of us really, as much as I love downtown, your meeting downtown are very difficult for anybody in this room to get to, because parking and getting around from the parking downtown is very challenging. So
great.
I suggest...
Okay, that's great feedback. So what?
I suggest that you... Yeah, the Omni's fine because it has its own parking.
Uh-huh.
But anything else downtown on the downtown area is just very difficult for us to get to.
Great. Well, I think we should look at rotating around different venues. One of the things we're going to do with this grant and with Jennifer's work is try things and see how they go, and then adjust and try different things. So it's sort of an iterative effort that we're going to make, and this is our first time doing it next week. We'll see how many people show up, and then if we'll try different venues. I think that's great feedback.
What time next week?
5:30 to 7 at SIPS. Thank you so much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.